Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of Poulton Civilization Site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
Episode 59. Hour and a half of archive segments. So we have an entire show of stuff we've recorded.
Oh, you're going to clear the vault?
Most of the good stuff, anyway. We are joined by multiple guests over several weeks, months, maybe even years. Well, okay, we haven't been on several years yet, but you get the general idea. Welcome to our clip show, but not just a lame clip show of clips that you've already heard before. No, these are clips from earlier episodes that we cut and we haven't been able to incorporate into any episode before. So if you're looking to describe this episode, this is Polycast episode 59, Clip Dump.
You're like, not lame clip show, not like the rest of the show is lame.
So, enjoy! Episode 36 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran Siddiqui, and Ra on Civilization 4 Multiplayer. From episode 46 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran Siddiqui, Cardamandua, Pinchak, and Canuck Soldier, adjusting tax rate city by city. From episode 49 with Dan Q, Makalua, Cardamandua, Oz, and Kale, workers won't stop building forts, timing of promotions, and guided missiles underpowered. From episode 51 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran Siddiqui, Cardamandua, and BT Oz, how much do you write down? From episode 55 with Dan Q, Makalua, Cardamandua, Alexander I, and Khan MCB-25, lack of diverse gameplay in Civilization 4 Colonization, on quests in general, is it ever worth a rush expansion to complete a quest, and on Woodsman 3 and Medics. From episode 58 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran Siddiqui, Cardamandua, Diamond Eye, and General W, memorable Civilization moments in 2008.
Talking about some sort of crap now.
So if we're talking about crap now, Imran, then what were we talking about before?
Oh, I don't know.
Yet more crap?
A lot of people are good SP players. I think, I mean, that keeps you from being bored because each game is actually different.
Yeah, and then you catch yourself doing some of the multiplayer techniques when you're playing single player and you realize, hey, this actually helps.
Yes, it does. I mean, in MP, you have to build a lot more early defenses. And you've got to judge the people you're playing with, and I guess that's what makes it fun. I mean, if you've got Krill next to you and you know he has bad land, you know he's coming to take your land. It's just a matter of when. And two warriors and an axeman in that city is not going to stop the horde.
Yeah.
At least you have an axeman.
Yeah. In SP, you can cut on the defense for the first 1,000 years and get away with it.
In terms of taking multiplayer strategy, you're saying in single player, you find it helps you when you open a chat window and you tell one of the AIs, you suck!
Strangely enough, no, that doesn't work.
Gosh darn it.
I have other ways of telling them they suck. Like when they give me their little demands, and I'm like, ha, no.
That's the fun of NP. You don't have a screen that comes up and says, somebody's plus 17 with you. You've got to guess. I mean, in the last game I played, Krill was next to me, and he taunted me to go after the player next to me, and as soon as my troops left the city to go to attack him, he gutted me. I mean, and I could feel better. I could really feel better than that, but I fell for the taunt. And that doesn't happen in a single-player game. Shaka doesn't come up and go, ah, why aren't you attacking that scum? You know, that just doesn't happen.
Unless you do some substances. Dude, Shaka so told me to attack that guy. Yeah.
And I believed him. And still, don't go out for a cigarette, whatever you do. Oh, but it's even like, but that's again, it's the MP. Even when I play with Ming. In general, we won't go after each other, but you've got to trust, but you've got to verify, because if he leaves himself open, I have no problem with going in and gutting him. And I've done that a few times. And he doesn't take it personally, which is good.
Episode
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. X-rayed city by city.
Why?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the advantage of this.
Yes, Waylon wants to know, is it possible to only change the tax rates in one city?
His example is if he wants to run a 100% science as empire, but wants his wealth-producing city to have 100% wealth. So he wants to be able to do something like that.
Well, you can't do that with taxes, but with production, of course, you could switch one of your cities over to, say, 100% wealth. And you'd probably want to do that with your wealthiest producing city or one of them. But, of course, you can't build anything then with them. I think that only has desirability in certain later game situations.
Yeah, it's very rare.
You can still specialize your city, specialize your specialists to make a city that's producing max science or money or culture or whatever. That already happens.
Well, it seems like it would turn your game to uber micromanaging stuff. A little over the top.
Kind of sounds like another mod candidate.
Yeah.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Rich won't stop making forts. Freaks out. Sports freak, LG. He says, I know I shouldn't put them on automate, but towards the end game I have no choice but to, otherwise it isn't fun managing everything. They simply won't stop making forts over important resources. I don't understand why. Is there a way to make them not to do it? Someone has indicated, although I don't put workers on automate myself, but from what I've observed from the AI, if there's an important resource outside of their city radius, they like to put a fort on it, particularly in Beyond the Sword.
I love this topic because I think there's a lot of players out there that are thinking this same thing, because the BTS AI does put forts on a lot of things if they're outside of the city radius and they think that that may be a bug. And they even go on in this thread and they talk about a little bit why it's doing it. And it's doing it because there isn't any reason to put a plantation or a farm or anything on that resource if it's not in the city cross, because that boosted production or food or whatever that you have from the farm or the plantation isn't going to apply to anything. So the AI looks at it and says, well, you know, I want to be able to gather this resource, and I could do that by putting a farm on here or a fort on here, but the farm doesn't get me anything since the city can't take advantage of it. So I'll put the fort here, and that way I get at least a little defensive bonus and still get the ability to gather the resource. So it's doing absolutely the thing that it should, but it does look a little odd because you see that, you know, your workers have built a wall around a bunch of corn, and it looks a little odd for new players.
Plus, forts take about twice as long to build than a plantation. Like, if you need that worker to do something else, he's sitting there for 25 turns building a fort. So.
Yeah, that's true. But in the end, the AI always looks at it from the end goal perspective. I mean, it does weigh out how much it takes to build it, but in general, it heavily weights towards, you know what, when this is all said and done, what will I have? It is easy to build another worker to get more cycles if you want them. So I think it's doing the right thing.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with it, really, honestly. It's just as strange, I agree. But if, on the other hand, I don't want Firaxis to start forcing us to build things. The reason I think this is because they had to up forts from the previous versions where nobody used forts, you know, and they had no real purpose other than for choke points. And I do still use forts for choke points with a huge war with a civ I'm having trouble with, and then I have a choke point, I'll build a fort. Or for, you know, air bases or something, a fort's a good thing. But they can't start forcing us to build forts all over the place for resources unless there's a purpose for it, and now there's a purpose for it, it's for resources. So I understand in that aspect.
Well, maybe more interesting where you have a strategic resource like iron or what have you that you really wanted to guard, and it's really nice now that instead of just having the mine on there, you could put a fort on it, you could put some units there, and you could protect it even better. So that's a cool feature.
Yeah, it could be tweaked a bit, but I agree. I don't care about the iron on the mountains. It's the plantations and the corn, which I think would be better with a farm, because what if you want to put a city there, you know, and you got to knock the fort down?
The only time I ever turn automation on with workers is in the end game, and that's to improve the trade network, which is essentially building railroads.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Timing of promotions. When a unit has gained a certain amount of experience in battle, it becomes eligible for promotion. Promotions give units special abilities, making the unit stronger, faster, or better in some other way. And Barclay summarize it as keep the choice to later and the healing, which is essentially the argument being that if you promote right away, you don't necessarily know if you want to go down a defensive or an offensive path. Unless you're in a particular conflict and you have a particular idea for that unit, the argument is that you should wait to promote so you don't, again, get locked into one path, and also for the ability when you apply a promotion to heal a unit. Now, it doesn't get you back to 100% ever, but because of that, and again, keeping the choice later, the argument is do not promote as soon as possible. I have always promoted as soon as possible. Part of that's because I can't stand not clicking on for the shiny with the blue... things, whatever we want.
That's the only reason I promote too, is the shiny.
Those buttons, they sit down there and they glow at you.
That's
and
right.
Taunt you if you don't.
And my little soldiers radiate blue radiation. I don't know.
I can definitely see the advantages of it. I don't know if I can bring myself to do it. I may very just well try that.
I do it a lot, honestly, for the healing benefit. If my unit wins a combat that allows him to promote, but he didn't get injured in the combat at all, so he's still sitting there at full health, that almost feels like a wasted promotion to get it right then. So I'd almost rather he gets a little wounding from some combat that he has a good chance of winning, and then using and then picking the promotion at that point to get that free healing back. I usually don't. The other thing that they mentioned about being able to be more flexible later on, it doesn't make much sense to pick a city attack promotion if you don't plan on attacking a city anywhere soon. So you leave it open, and then you grab the city attack later, right before you attack the city. That makes good sense to me, but I don't typically follow that one.
The only downside, there's upsides to everything. Dan missing the shiny is pretty annoying, but the other downside is the defensive aspect. If you're sitting on a stack of, say, 5 units that haven't been promoted, all of a sudden you're sneak attacked and you're bombarded and nailed. You don't get any kind of bonus if you're sitting on a promotion. Your units will just get wiped out. Even if you have, like, 30-something XP, it won't matter because you're dead. The defensive aspect is the only bad thing. You can't defend yourself with no promotions if you're sneak attacked. That's the only bad thing I can think of.
And, of course, if you were sneak attacked, getting City Raider promotion isn't going to help you there. So
that's true.
It's kind of nice to have it open. If you see them coming, then you can say, oh, I was going to make this guy a City Attacker, but, you know, I have this stat coming over here, and I'm not going to be using City Attack. So let's put some points and get a couple levels in combat so we can help defend. An interesting sidelight is the way that Civilization Revolution handles promotions is as soon as the unit wins 3 combats, he is eligible. It randomly picks 2 promotions and gives you the option of which one do you want. So it's not like Civilization 4 where you get the whole list of things that you could pick and you have a lot of control over how exactly you want to level this unit. And there's no experience points in Civ Rev. It's just you've won 3 combats, boom. This time you can learn combat or blitz or whatever 2 that it picks for you randomly. Makes it a lot simpler, but it's kind of cool too in that it's so fast and easy to play with a controller, which is, of course, is what Civ Rev is all made for. I don't know what you guys thought about that or if you played much Civ Rev.
I haven't played it, but Dan has extensively playtested it. Dan, what do you think about the promotions?
I remember from playtesting it with the promotions, and as Derek said, as soon as you win 3 battles and you're being promoted into veteran status and then another 3, then you can get into elite status and you're given, as I said, promotion capabilities, not experience points, and you have to choose between the ones that are presented to you at that moment. But you can't decide to sit on them. Now, what that did for me is that made me think about my immediate circumstances. There are some promotions, for example, that will, I can't think of the exact name right now, and there are 9 of them, but one of them work better, for example, if you're defending within your territory and then attacking within an enemy territory. And I was on the defensive, and so there was a promotion option that would give me some additional defense inside my territory, or another one would allow the unit to move faster. If I was winning the war and I was trying to get some more units to the front there, I might have chosen the one that allowed the unit to move faster. And I wasn't thinking about 50, 100 turns later, oh, that it might actually be beneficial to be able to have it move faster than defend because I'm better off then. It's a different approach to it. I liked it.
It sounds pretty useful. Guided missiles. I have literally decimated countries with guided missiles unfairly. I have sent over carriers and submarines for overseas battles and completely annihilated their entire army in less than really 3 turns. If you do it properly, guided missiles are extremely dangerous. They're so nasty.
Yeah, I don't agree with the Ministry at all, who says, am I missing something or are my guided missiles not doing enough damage? I disagree that guided missiles are underpowered. They are one of three units in the game with 40 strength and the only air one, because you've also got modern armor on land and you've got missile cruisers in the sea. Now, it's true that guided missiles can only be used once, but they cost 60 hammers.
That's what I was going to say, they're cheap.
Now, modern armor and missile cruisers, it's likely that, yes, you're going to be able to use those more than once, but they're 240 and 260 hammers, respectively. If you were going to criticize anything, really, about the guided missiles, I would say it's their range. Because someone raises that, it's not that they're underpowered, it's that their range is too limited. I don't think they're limited. I know some people have said that, well, that's not realistic. In real life, they have greater range capability. But again, when it comes to gameplay, I think that the range limit is important. They have 100% chance of evading interception, and they can destroy tile improvements and bomb city defenses at 16% a turn. Compare that to, at the time, an artillery, which also has a 60% capability, which, yes, may be used more than one turn, but they're less than half the strength at 18, and they cost 150 hammers. And again, going back to the 60 hammers, I mean, when's the last time in the game that you'll see 60 hammers when you're building crossbowmen and pikemen?
Yeah, you can build even the cheap cities, like the size 2s. Again, if you just put on production, nothing but production, they can pump out the missiles. And your big cities can build the tanks and all that stuff with all your wonders to build your super tanks with 20 XP out the gate. And then you just get like 5 or 6 transports, and then you load up whatever holds cruise missiles, submarines, aircraft, the carriers, whatever. And you can just literally just destroy anybody. If a weak country, even a medium-sized strength country, will stand no chance whatsoever. In fact, I think there should be some defense against cruise missiles.
If there's anything that perhaps should be changed with missiles, it's the fact that right now you can stockpile them in cities. There's no limit. They introduced the aircraft limit of 8 in cities, which was important. And then, of course, with the patch, realized, oh, shoot, you could still have unlimited aircraft in friendly cities. Oh, better fix that, and they did that. But you can stockpile them. Perhaps that should be addressed, given how strong they are, the damage that they can cause, the cost that's involved, the evasion chance. And again, going back to crossmen and pikemen, yes, there's 60 hammers as well, but think about the time in the game when you could build them. You're not having the benefits of factories and power plants and possibly a number of even more engineering specialists and great engineers to be able to turn those out rather quickly. This thread got me thinking because, unlike Ian, I have not used guided missiles hardly at all. Having read this, I'm rethinking that.
You'll be impressed at how effective they are. I know they're one time, but just think of it this way. You have the catapults and you have the artillery for collateral damage. That is all for nothing compared to the collateral damage. You have like 10 cruise missiles, which are cheap, and your cheap cities can build it. And instead of building something like a temple in 30 turns, you can build a cruise missile in 15. And just, you know, you have a whole bunch of cruise missiles, and you don't need artillery. You don't need the collateral damage or the bombard for tanks. You just bombard everybody with your cruise missiles, move in your army, and that's it. It overrides artillery.
And unlike ICBMs and nukes, which, of course, you have the potential fallout issue, missiles cannot be not built because someone brings in the United Nations and you vote to ban nuclear weapons. Or otherwise, you don't have to wait for someone to build the Manhattan Project, fail to build them. The guided missiles don't have that limitation or that downside. This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
A question by Necom, or Necom, asking, how much do you write down? He takes extensive notes in his game. His wife doesn't get it, asks why I'm playing the game for fun, am I doing homework? He keeps several pages of graph paper with charts on all of his cities, what they're for, and how many units, how many resources he controls or trades, all of their civs, how many times they begged for a free tech, demanded stop trading all of his invasion forces. Jesus Christ.
That's about what I said when I got that part of the list.
Let me just say, I have never once taken notes during a sim game.
I mean, we made fun of Mackie for charting her game out.
Yeah, really?
I don't do that in Civ 4, but it was a thing I did, like, with Civ 3 and stuff, because, like, I would be bored, like, at class or something, and I'd be like, okay, let's chart this. Let's see, I'm going to put that city there and that city, you know.
Yeah, that's still kind of scary.
She does it now when she's in business meetings.
Thinking, when I get home tonight, let's see, list things to do. Kick Montezuma's ass.
I'm going to start doing that in meetings.
Well, wait a minute. You actually have to write that out? Don't you have that on, like, a letterhead or something? I mean, why would you have to write that out all the time? It's just a given.
Yeah, it's like a default thing, but, you know, just to state how much I need to do that, let me actually put it on my list.
Yo, list.
See, I used to take notes in some earlier versions of Civ, like, for example, what units were protecting them and what resources I controlled or traded. But thanks to the interface in Civ 4 that Civ 4 brought about, I don't really feel the need to do that. Like, with the diplomacy, it talks about all other cities, how many times they've begged for a tech tree, demanded I go to war, etc. Well, you don't...
Well, that's easy. You look down on the side and see how pissed off they are.
Exactly. Exactly. So I don't take anywhere near as number of notes that I used to. Only a small fraction. In fact, the only time in Civ 4, in any Civ 4 game, I could think I'd take notes, is if I have a particular resource that I have an excess of that I'm looking to trade, and I look at the trade screen, and I see, okay, this person will take that because they are in need of that resource. I see how much gold per turn they have. I go to the person that's getting the most gold per turn, ask how much they'll give me, and if it's less than the maximum of the next person, then I'll say, okay, I'm going to write down what you said you'll give me, and then I'll go to the next person, and if necessary, I'll keep track of who's going to give me the most gold per turn. And then I go with the person who will give me the most gold per turn in that turn, and then discard the note. That's about it.
I have, well, not written, but typed out in Notepad notes for when I've played, like, the Tri-League games. So I have some sort of a note as to what I was doing early on and what I was thinking, so I can explain why I did well or why I completely screwed up. That's about the only other time I make notes, though.
Johnny Rico, in this thread, said he went from taking extensive notes to building a spreadsheet for his games. Who are these people?
Okay, no. I've done a spreadsheet for a couple of games that have really intense crafting systems, but for Civilization, what the crap?
I don't make notes, but I get stuck in a game. I phone a friend. What do I do?
Or do they go for the 50-50?
I would love that. That'd be awesome.
Post on the forums, I need help. It's 1.06 a.m. 1.09 a.m. Why haven't you guys responded yet? You suck!
People are questioning if there's a lack of diverse gameplay in Civ 4 Call. I haven't had it long enough to tell you that.
And I haven't played it since the beta, so it's not repetitive for me anymore.
I haven't played it since the beta either. Gundog says, so it seems as though the majority of the games are all played out the same way with no diversity. From turn one, I basically know what's going to go on. Found city, trade with Europe or natives, or war with the natives. Aside from that, there really isn't much going on. Sure, you could war with the other nations, but there really isn't much diversity or diplomacy or replay value, unquote. Quite a few people in this thread seem to agree with that position. Although I think, again, we're talking about Civilization IV colonization. We're talking about a really detailed piece of history. And we know what the end result is to be, which is to declare independence. And someone has said perhaps this should have been called Civilization IV War of Independence as opposed to Civilization IV colonization. Because to them, colonization is about the actual colonizing and not about the presumed end point of declaring independence.
It does seem to kind of be oriented around all of the colonies becoming independent nations. You know, what about your little Canada? Maybe your British colonists are founding Canada, not the United States. Why are the British leaderheads, the English colonists, just George Washington and John Adams? Or, like, the Spanish have Simon Bolivar and José de San Martín?
You can turn off the victories except time, which technically you'd still be a colony of your motherland, which you just would have won a time victory.
Yeah, I guess so. It just seems like it's especially oriented towards having a revolutionary war of some sort.
Because it was based on U.S. history and not other colonies' history is why.
Precisely, as most things with Firaxis. And never mind. When I played it, I was thinking, won't the leaderheads be whoever is founding the first colony or something? I was expecting the Spanish to have, like, Cortez and Pizarro instead of Bolivar. But it shows how right I was. At least in my opinion, it's focusing more on the independence than on the actual colonization.
Well, I think Civ 4 colonization has a lack of diverse gameplay. But then, you know, so did the original colonization. Maybe the game would have been better if it did have some more diverse gameplay, but all in all, I think it did a pretty good job of updating the original colonization. There may be some balancing issues here and there that need to be done, but we're not really playing another Civ 4 game. You're playing a colonization game or War of Independence or whatever else you want to call it.
Well, and I think right there that's the key, is that Gundog, in his original post, he is comparing it to vanilla Civ 4, saying in regular Civ 4 there was ton more options. He's comparing that Civ 4 to colonization. They're completely different games with different objectives.
So I think that calling it Civ 4 colonization is a little bit misleading. My personal preference would have been if they called it Colonization 2 and just said it was on the Civ 4 engine. When you throw in that Civ 4 there, people are expecting it to be like Civ 4.
Yeah, I think that may have been the marketing people at work on that.
Yep, curse them.
Even Civilization colonization. If they wanted to say that, well, we don't want to call this Colonization 2 because we haven't really gone into adding that much more, as has been argued, would be preferred to Civilization 4 colonization. It is kind of strange that, and of course being a standalone expansion pack, which is also a very strange sort of sounding phrase when you think about it.
Yeah, but I just think it opens up a can of strangeness for future titles. Civilization 4, Colonization 2, Civilization 5. Pirates.
Pirates.
David Cutler, one of his suggestions is that the strength of the Royal Expeditionary Force needs to be ramped way up, where Liberty Bells need to have some effect on the REF. After all, it makes sense that the king would ramp up his forces as rebellion begins to smolder. But money, as in colonization, first colonization, is also a great mechanism and forces the player to consider how to spend his money wisely.
Haven't people been complaining if the REF is too strong?
Yeah, maybe he's on the hidden preceptor level.
Preceptor level.
Ooh.
The Dan Q level. I don't know, I think it makes sense, though, for the royals to be really strong. You know, the Americans almost lost their War of Independence because the British were so strong. It was only the French coming in that made it happen for America. Yes, I know, the French won the war for us. Isn't that shocking?
David Cutler says you also need to be able to trade with the colonial powers, albeit at a price less than with the home country and with ramifications of improving the diplomatic standing with the EP and angering your own king.
You could trade with the other colonial powers in the first game. It didn't do anything to your diplomatic standing, but it was, once you'd gotten embargoed on certain goods, that way you still had a way to sell them before customs houses.
So there's room in there for some sort of conditions for a diplomatic victory, maybe even an economic victory, although Snoopy369, as he does say, would be very complex to balance, though. True, maybe just have one or the other. Maybe a diplomatic victory. There are 18 quests in Civilization IV Beyond the Sword, and I went through the 18, and I thought, okay, of the ones that I have seen or have I not seen, which ones would I be going for? Xane said that he prefers unit building quests because it's always nice to have that extra incentive to build more units and keep the power graph up. Certainly, any ones that are asking me to build more of X type of units, I'm usually going to go for because, yeah, I'd probably be building those extra units anyway. Going through the quests, there is the Horse Whispering quest. Has anyone had this one before?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I've had that.
All mounted units get the sentry promotion, and all stables provide +1 food as long as you build X number of stables. I think that's a fair one.
But why can't I get that when I'm playing the Mongols?
You don't cross your fingers tight enough. The classic literature one, the libraries. Now, the thing is with this one, you get +2 research in the triggering city's library. Of course, if that was +2 research in all of your libraries, well then. Now, it may be worthwhile if you actually control the Great Library Wonder, because then you get +1 scientist specialist for this wonder. But otherwise, I'd actually probably leave that one alone. I think, actually, among my favorites is the Master Blacksmith, where all swordsman units gain the shock promotion, which is +25% versus melee units. And if you have a state religion, you gain 1 engineer specialist in the triggering city. But just for that swordsman unit alone, which I tend to use swordsman in my games anyway. Woohoo!
I think that one is actually extremely useful. It makes your swordsman survive a bit longer, I would say. Well, it seemed a little bit pointless to me to have one of every little type of unit to make sure I had a balanced stack so that I wasn't rocked by some random whatever. That goes back to that too many units thing. Got to have your spearmen to protect against your cavalry, plus your axemen to do the melee fighting. And then your swordsmen, I mean, your swords, for some reason, don't work so well in melee fighting, but they're good against cities. Okay. It makes sense to me to have a melee bonus for swordsmen.
Now, for someone like me who is a builder and often finds himself on the defensive rather than the offensive, who would have thought that I would be recommending the best defense quest? Where you just have to have, on a standard size map, 7 castles, where all melee units gain the City Garrison 1 promotion, which is plus 20% city defense, and you gain plus 3 attitude with all the AIs you have met. Wow. Now, it's true it goes obsolete, like all of these, but nevertheless, I'll take it particularly earlier on in the game, because as a builder and on the defense, it's usually in the later game that I catch up as far as strength goes, so if I can get plus 20% city defense for the units that I do have, the melee units that I do have, and the plus 3 attitude.
Well, that, and you'll have to do it earlier on in the game because your castles will obsolete so quickly.
Yes, that's right. Now, the Sports League quest, which gives you plus 1 happy face for every Colosseum and plus 4 culture for every Colosseum, assuming you get this quest come up and you have the minimum number of Colosseums, which is 7 for a standard size map. I really don't get that one very much, but I actually, even though I'm a builder, I'm really not going for that. I'd rather be concentrating and having my Colosseums and my temples and my theaters. Oh, there's an elite swords, and so again with the swordsman, and that gives all swordsmen the City Raider 1 promotion, plus 20% city attack. If I got that one, I'd go for that. The same with the noble knights, where all knight units gain the flanking 1 promotion, plus 10% withdrawal chance. And the Overwhelm quest. Has anyone ever seen Overwhelm? I don't even think I've ever heard anyone talk about this or mention this one.
I don't remember. I don't know what that is.
The aim is to build 4 destroyers, 2 battleships, 3 carriers, and 9 fighters.
Jeez.
Where all of those units gain the Combat 1 promotion, that's plus 10% strength, and all harbors gain plus 5 commerce. So, of course, you have to have flight, seeing as how being able to build fighters, as well as industrialism. And the map has to be at least 55% water tiles, again, considering all of the melee units. I think the part that I couldn't help but smile at was the third result. If Manhattan Project has been built past the nuke ban resolution, which I'm not really sure where that came from, but okay.
Rush expansion.
Oh, wait. Is it ever worth a rush expansion to complete a quest?
Yeah, this KCD Swede says he's currently chasing 2 quests. One is the Holy Mountain and the other being the Harbor Master. In order to keep on steady financially, my research has had to drop to 60%. My main question is, do the effects of the completed quest ever outweigh the effects of a rushed expansion? Or is it a fool's errand? Goes on to follow up saying, there seems to be no direct penalty for not completing quests, only the possibility that a rival will complete it. Does the AI go for quests? Now, I got looking in the Civilopedia, and we've always talked about events as your standard events and quests, but apparently, according to the Civilopedia, we should be referring to these standard events as occurrences.
We've always called them events.
In any event, quests require the player to complete a certain objective in order to receive a reward. And as DGL Thrawn is getting at, you need to hurry as many quests, but not all, are given to multiple civilizations at the same time, meaning the first to complete will garner the benefits.
But the benefits, I don't think, are that wonderful.
KCD Sweet says that AI do run quests and seem to prioritize them more than would be intelligent. I've never seen one of these bonuses turn a game yet. I don't really think a quest is intended to turn a game. I don't really think that's a negative to put in the quest column, but I don't think rushing to complete a quest is ever a good idea unless you're really bored, and if you're really bored, probably means that you're playing on too easy a difficulty level, and you should be playing at a higher difficulty level.
Yep, the quests are for flavor.
Considering the fact that, let's take the Holy Mountain as an example, if you do settle near the Holy Mountain, you get plus 1 happy face in all your cities. Well, you know, once a game is that advanced, usually that doesn't make that much difference anyway. So I don't think I've ever rushed or made a major attempt to go after a quest. If it's easy and handy, sure, I'll go for it. If it's something like chasing a Holy Mountain all the way on the other side of the world, I usually don't even bother.
Yeah. And the Holy Mountain, not only is there really not that much benefit, I don't think, for how much work you've got to put into it, but sometimes where the Holy Mountain is selected, you can't settle near it because it's like a one-tile
island.
Mountain.
Yeah.
Nowhere.
I've had that happen.
And sometimes it's really hard to find anyway. I think they should make it glow. You know, that would be the Holy Mountain, the one that's glowing.
The one that's shiny.
Shimmery. Magical.
Congratulations, your scientists have discovered the secrets of radiation.
Not that kind of glowing.
The holy mountain should be where the holy grail is.
Oh, that would explain how my leader lived 6,000 years.
Can only be found if you have the Indiana Jones great general.
Or maybe they should just go for the realism and your people call the mountain nearest them the holy mountain.
There you go.
Which mountain is holy? The one that we live next to.
Now the Harbor Master quest, that one I think could be more worthwhile, where you get all naval units gain the combat one promotion, all harbors gain plus one gold, and all naval units also gain the navigation one promotion. Its weight isn't as strong as Holy Mountain, only about a quarter or so. I've seen Holy Mountain, but I've never seen the Harbor Master. Now, of course, it also depends on just how important a navy is to you if you're all on a single continent. The navy can come into effect as far as the coastal cities go, but you need to take into account just how much coastal real estate you have. Super 49er says, I would only complete a quest if it was something I would do anyway, like build harbors or forges. And yeah, although it's usually, I find it's not, oh, it's something that I would do anyway, but the number, it's like, yeah, right, sure, I'll continue to build the harbors in my coastal cities and forges in my cities, but I have to have how many now? I like actually the me and team's response, perhaps maybe puts it best, which is there are a lot of good reasons to rush expansion and quests generally earn a month. In the end to this, DGL Thrawn says that, I managed to complete both quests. The Holy Mountain was right down by the South Pole. Ice everywhere, but at least it was coastal. And he has decided to move up a level from Chieftain to Warlord, and as a consequence, I'm ignoring the quests to concentrate on the main aspects of gameplay.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Woodman 3 and Medics. Carl Corey decided to do a little test with the new Woodsman. Well, it was new back in August of 2007. The new Woodsman Promotion 3 gives the unit the ability to heal units in the same tile an extra 15%. Does this stack with any of the Medic promotions? I made a test using World Builder on a finished game of mine. He got a catapult down to 1.8 health out of 5 and then did a series of tests, which you can see for yourself on Civ Fanatics if you want to go check that out. The conclusion is if Medic and Woodsman 3 promotions are on different units, they don't stack up. The bigger healing wins. Medic 3 is the best healing rate. If the Medic and the Woodsman 3 promotions are on the same unit, they do stack up. Medic 1, Woodsman 3 is equivalent to Medic 3, while a Medic 3, Woodsman 3 unit has the best healing rate you can get. Looks like the whole gist of this idea is being able to stack Woodsman 3 on top of Medic to get a super healing unit in Civilization.
I want some.
As a builder, it really doesn't have any impact on me in the sense that I never get to 3 anything as far as promotions go, but some of my units can have more than 3 promotions, but I find myself never going far enough down one promotion line to, if I am actually to the point where I could get 3, that I've got the first 2, I generally am not going to go to the third, because by getting the first or even the second one, it has opened up the ability for mine to get one of another, depending upon my particular unit. Having one unit with the Medic promotion in the stack is very advantageous, but beyond Medic 1, I wouldn't be doing that.
I tend to use the same combination of promotions every time I play. Never, ever pick Woodsman.
Woodsman? I have a tendency to use that with my early game scouts just about every game I play.
On scouts only, that would be it.
Yeah, I guess I do use Woodsman 1, but definitely not the third one.
I think I've probably used Woodsman 2 on numerous occasions. I believe you have to go to the second promotion to get the movement bonus, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So I've gone to Woodsman 2, I'm sure, quite a few times. I've never really thought about the Woodsman 3 combined with Medic, though. That actually sounds kind of interesting if your goal is to go smash somebody's head after you've done some buildering. One thing I found is especially in the earlier portions of the game, you know, you'll go on an extended campaign to wipe another civ out if you're going for, let's say, a conquest victory, and you get over into his neck of the woods and you're pounding away, and then you've got to wait forever for the darn units to heal up. So if you had that kind of a strategy, this definitely sounds like something useful for your scouts who maybe already have woodsmen too. If you could get them promoted a little bit more and then add medic, it might definitely help with that kind of a strategy.
You see, I didn't even know there was a Woodsman 3 until actually when I was playing Colonization the other day, because I had a scout get experience two villages in a row, and I was like, wait, there's a Woodsman 3? Wait, this heals? What?
You mean Civ 4 call?
Yes, yes. Excuse me.
I thought so, but I just like to be a you-know-what disturber.
I don't always have a Civ that has scouts to start with, so I'm scouting with warriors, so that first couple of warriors that I send out to scout end up getting Woodsman promotions. Because they only have one move, and once you get that second promotion, they can be moving on the forest tiles two at a time. And then at some point, I'll usually bring them back in, and at that point, they can get further combat promotions.
I'm a lumberjack, and I'm okay. Oh, wait, we're not the singer.
I'll give you an exception, because it was Monty Python.
I've got to agree with that. I probably get at least one or two combat units a game that get up the Woodsman too. And in all reality, even if your primary strategy was conquest or domination or whatever, how many units are you really going to need that have this promotion? So possibly a really good way to use those early scouts to help heal your larger stacks as you get further along in the game.
Yeah, now that I know about this combination, I might deliberately try to do that so I have a good healer to go with the stack.
I couldn't agree more. I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay.
Sleep all night and work all day.
From 2008 in the Civilization world. On February 1st, the Firaxis announced that Civilization Revolution for the Wii gaming console is on indefinite hold. According to a spokesperson for 2K Games at the time, we are focusing our attention on creating the best possible Civilization experience for the Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, and Nintendo DS platforms. On July 8th, Civilization Revolution now available worldwide with its North American release. This next one is a bit egotistical, but live with it. July 26th, the Bolton Civilization site turns 10. That's memorable. August 10th, the Entertaining Software Ratings Board, or the ESRB, kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit by listing on their website that the Macintosh platform will be supported on Civilization 4 Colonization.
Oops. Good job, ESRB.
Yeah, it was funny.
August 19th, the hostile takeover bid of game publisher and developer Take-Two Interactive by rival Electronic Arts expired the day before, but it appears that only this chapter in the story has ended and not the story itself. And then finally, on September 22nd, Civilization IV Colonization released, the first standalone expansion for Civilization IV. Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@polton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.polton.net.
Music in the background. The best part of waking up is Polycast in your cup.
Don't stop.
Thinking about tomorrow.
Being so poopy.
He just pulled my piggy tail.
I like paste.
Am I eating paper? Again.
Record date.
Sorted 2008.
Sound clips copyright Civilization 4 and the Warlords and Beyond the Sword expansion packs. copyright 2008 Poulton's Civilization site at poulton's.net.